Hello, I'm Helen Dalley. Welcome to Build It, They'll Come. Candid interviews with amazing Australian entrepreneurs who started with a humble idea and built it into something substantial and sustainable. It's the human face behind how they built it. On today's episode...
It's built around low cost. It is actually biodegradable. I describe it as a flying shoebox. Whatever you can fit in a shoebox, you can get in the air and deliver remotely for isolated people.
The man you'll hear from today reckons his advanced engineering company is an overnight success, just 30 years in the making. Systems integration engineer George Vicino, who migrated to Australia from Sicily as a toddler, used the skills, training and expertise he gained from his years in the Australian Air Force to then strike out on his own, founding the SIPAC Group, first as a systems integration consultancy and later as a manufacturer of highly sophisticated, very clever engineering products. While George's company helps large government departments and big corporates turn their technology systems into customer-centric, usable experiences, one of their products recently launched this boutique Melbourne company onto the global stage. In conjunction with the Australian government and defence, George Vicino's SIPAC group sent its very clever drones to the front line in Ukraine to help the Ukraine army fight the Russian invasion. Now, these aren't some high-powered, super-duper, turbocharged metal drones. No, the Corvo drones, invented by SIPAC's in-house engineers, are made from waxed cardboard held together essentially by rubber bands and a bit of glue, and most amazingly, can be flat packed like IKEA furniture and assembled in the battlefield by an ordinary soldier to fly logistics or surveillance missions over enemy lines. Make no mistake, while they seem like a child's flimsy plaything, they are proving to be devilishly smart and deceptively effective. Here's George Vicino. George Vicino, thank you so much for joining me on Build It, They'll Come.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Helen. I'm really looking forward to this chat.
Oh, good. Well, now you're the founder and owner of the SIPAC Group, and I think you bill yourself on the website as an innovative engineering and systems integration company, started way back over 30 years ago in 1992, I think. So what is it exactly that SIPAC does that you do?
Well, look, we're actually quite a diverse group, even though we tend to stick to our customers are generally defence or various forms of federal state governments. But we are quite diverse in that we have, at one end, we have a consulting business, which is still, that's how I started the business, in fact. So we still have that side of our business. It's quite a significant part of our business. But our ambitions were really moved towards what we call in the defence circle the prime systems integrator or systems integrator. And so we've been building towards that over the journey. And so now we have part of our business, which we call innovation and strategic projects. But really that's our systems integration part of our business. And we also now, as you would have seen in the various press releases over the air show, we also have a product line largely around autonomous systems in the air domain, but we are working on some ocean surface autonomous systems as well as we speak. So we're quite diverse.
Yeah. Well, so George, you're obviously a trained engineer who much earlier in your career, worked for the Australian Air Force. Now one of your most recent claim to fame is one of these autonomous systems. And I want to start with that you've supplied drones to the Ukraine army to help them in their fight against Russia after the invasion and that conflict. Now, these drones you've made are made from cardboard and they're able to be flat packed.
So you're working with the military again.
Well, we are indeed.
So tell me how these drones work. They just seem extraordinary.
Well, the concept is quite simple. That's what I loved about it when our chief engineer brought it to me as an idea. And I said, that is brilliant. So the concept is very simple. It needs to be very cost effective because they are disposable. At least the airframe is disposable. Now, the clever bit is actually the very sophisticated and advanced miniature electronics in it, which do all the, obviously, all the navigation guidance and takeoff and landing and control. So that's the very clever bit.
So just a minute, for a layperson, is this like a tiny little chip that's obviously a super smart one that guides it, or is there an operator sitting, you know, in a bunker or in a building some kilometres away?
No, this particular aircraft is actually fully autonomous. The operator in the field, they get a sort of an iPad, and they program. It's fitted with the software, but they program the coordinates where they want this thing to go to land, and that's then they launch it.
So it guides itself.
It's fully autonomous, yes, and there's no in the basic version. There's no communication with the ground beyond after they've launched it, basically.
Right. So how much weight can it carry, George? And how far can it go? How far can it fly?
One of the clever bits of this particular product is that it's actually doesn't have. If you don't want it to come back, what it means is you get twice the range that you normally would have. So this will fly up to 120 kilometres, which is quite a distance when you're in a, you know, in trying to drop off either in a battlefield, but also when you can't get near a disaster site or something like that. What you want to do is get supplies to the people that are trapped there, and this is what this aircraft was built for. So you can stand off up to 120 kilometres and get water, ammunition, medication, medical supplies, and probably even a light blanket to keep people warm.
Wow, that's amazing. So if you don't want it to come back, you say it can fly 120 kilometres. If you do want it to come back and bring you information or if it's been on surveillance or reconnaissance, it flies 60 k's.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it all depends on the weight you load. It will carry. It's designed to carry 3 kilometres to that range.
Three what?
They have. 3 kilograms.
Kilos. It's okay. So that's not that big. That's not that much weight.
They have been. Using them up to 5 kilograms.
Oh, and amazing.
But it depends on the weight. The range will be dependent on the weight.
George, you and your team, you said your chief engineer, by all means give him a shout out because he sounds like a genius. Did you actually invent this cardboard and rubber band drone?
Yes, we did. Well, our people did. Ross Osborne, I'm happy to name him, is a genius. I always tell him that. He and his people amaze me every day. That's why I keep coming into work just to talk to these guys. They are brilliant. And the idea came from, the Army has what they call Army Innovation Days, usually every year, but in COVID they had them. They didn't have many. But Ross says, we'll take this to Innovation Day and see what they think of it.
So he invents the cardboard one first. How did he come up with the concept of using cardboard that could possibly work?
Well, it was built around low cost and basically dispensable,
And therefore sustainable if you're using something like cardboard.
Yeah, and yes, and it is actually biodegradable. So he said, well, it's primarily I describe it as a flying shoebox, basically. You whatever you can fit in a shoebox, you can get in the air and deliver to remotely isolated people.
Right. So he came up with this. He obviously built a prototype, was it? And then you went to this Army Innovation Day, or did you have a full production line going? Just paint us a picture of how that occurred.
All right. Well, what you have to do to get a tick in the box at these Army Innovation Days is, in fact, you need a proof of concept.
Right.
So our guys, Ross, went to that day with a proof of concept. And from there, Army actually liked it because it actually solves what they call last mile logistics issues in the battlefield for them. And so then they actually ticked the box and said, yeah, we'll fund the development of this product. And so to their credit, they actually put their money where their mouth is and funded it. I think, I don't remember the figure exactly, but they funded it to where it was basically what you see now, where we have a viable product.
So is it like, $100,000 or is it $1 million or a $10 million funding at that initial stage?
It's closer to $1 million.
Right.
So, and it goes in phases. So you have to do confirm your proof of concept.
For sure.
Et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, then there's a final test phase where you prove that it meets all the customers' requirements.
Yeah, so it did. Right, so they loved it when they first saw it at this Innovation Day. So they put money in, and I understand you produce it, you manufacture it at your Centre for Excellence in Melbourne or near Port Melbourne, Fisherman's Bend.
Yeah, well, that's where I'm seated in the office area of that Defence or Autonomy Centre of Excellence here in Port Melbourne. And if I go downstairs to where these are made, there's about, I think, four laser cutters which cut cardboard, and then there's a guys there working on benches assembling and testing the guidance the modules and also the motor control systems there.
So they're like the IKEA furniture. They are flat packed. How easy are they to assemble in the field?
Look, proof of the pudding is actually in giving it to the guys in the field, and some of the soldiers are not engineers, not most of them aren't, but we had the complexity in Ukraine where English was an issue. So what we've done is provided them, obviously, with the tools. Every kit comes with the tools to assemble them. But we've provided them with basically videos of one of our guys assembling and connecting these things together. And they've been quite successful in doing it. So
it's extraordinary.
It's not a complicated I've done one myself, and right, it's actually not that complicated.
So what, you just need a spanner, or what do you need? What tools?
There's one bolt, and I think it's to do with the motor.
Wow.
That you've got to actually bolt something down. But other than that, it's all glue, and the wings are held on, as you might have seen, by rubber bands, which sort of you put over the wings and clip them on to.
It's just extraordinary. It sounds like a little boy's Meccano set.
Oh, well, it actually is. If I had something like that when I was little, I remember we used to get the balsa wood aircraft and there were rubber bands in them, and you'd do the propeller up and away it goes. This is exactly what it's like.
It's amazing.
It's cardboard.
Amazing. So, George, what exactly does it do? We sort of brushed over that at the beginning, or what can it do? And how are they being used in Ukraine?
Well, look, it's designed as a logistics. When we say logistics, basically to move
goods or
stuff, goods or stuff from one place to another where it's needed, and primarily that's how they've been using it in the Ukraine. So it's a resupply of ammunition, rations or food, water, and that sort of thing, and getting it to where soldiers, the soldier can't come back and get that stuff, and to send someone in there to give it to them could cost a life. So they're using primarily for that function. They also use them for what we call ISR, or intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance, which initially they were just simply strapping GoPro cameras to them. Then when they got back, they would basically download the images, and they knew what was
right
out there at a distance of whatever range they were looking at. We've been asked we've built an ISR version, which has a module you fit to the aircraft. You cut a hole in the bottom and you fit it to the shoebox, and it has a retractable camera gimbal, a stabilized gimbal, mm-hmm. which will point wherever you want the camera to point, and the aircraft can move around and it stays pointed at the target. So we've developed that as a result of feedback from the Ukraine.
And right, and how many of those have you sent over so far?
Of the ISR version? Mm. We're about to send the first kits for that. So there'll be the aircraft, and we'll send those kits over, and they install them there.
Fantastic. And how many of the non-ISR, the name, how many of the ISR, original ones, ISR, have you sent?
And
are they operational?
Yes, they are operational. And although we announced it only just recently at the Avalon Air Show, we have indeed been shipping them for several months, probably 8 months. So, and at a rate of about 100 a month. So we're probably getting up to 600-700 by now.
Fantastic. Yeah. Now, I understand they can carry a bomb, and is that what they're doing, using them for in Ukraine?
Yes, well, they're like any drone. And, you can buy a drone off the shelf, go to Dick Smith or wherever and buy a drone, and you can fit explosives to it. So they're no different to any other drone. They're not designed to do that, but we don't actually control how they're used in the field. And, logically you would assume that maybe it may be used for that purpose, but we're certainly not. We haven't built them or designed them for that purpose. And we don't like to put them as what we call a lethal drone.
But they have that capacity, George.
They have indeed. And that's exactly, people talk about kamikaze drones. That's exactly what they are. They're sophisticated flying aircraft with precision guidance systems. So,
okay. So just for my listeners, so we get that straight, a kamikaze drone is the one that flies and just flies into something and blows it up.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So our precision payload delivery system, or PPDS, is not built or designed for that purpose. But we don't control how people use them in the field, so I can't say any more than that, because we don't know what they're being used for. But they're primarily being used for the ISR function and the resupply.
Yeah, and what sort of feedback have you had about those two functions, the ISR, the reconnaissance and the surveillance, and then the logistics supply?
They love them. In fact, one of our biggest fans is Vasyl, the Ukrainian ambassador. He's got to know us reasonably well. He's visited us recently, and so he said his people love them. We do get feedback from the users in the field. One bit of feedback we got was, hey, GPS doesn't work in the battlefield, because guess what? It's jammed by the enemy, the Russians.
Right.
So we've now producing them with what we call GPS denied capability. So they can navigate quite and quite happily without GPS.
So the drone itself can navigate itself without GPS?
Yes, there's sophisticated technology. It uses a system called partly inertial navigation. In other words, its direction and speed will determine if it knows where it's leaving from. Its direction and speed, it will know where it is. And the other thing it has, the latest versions have, is a sophisticated way of mapping the landscape so it can find its way back.
The deal to supply Ukraine with your special new drones, was that done directly by your team or did it go through Australian Defence? Because obviously you said the Army put money in the beginning, or the Australian government?
To our defence and our government's credit, it was they that suggested that the PPDS, the aircraft we're talking about now, would
the automated
be,
drones. That's your official name, PPDS. Yes. Yep.
Yeah, they could be quite useful in the Ukraine.
Yeah,
and so they, when they promised to supply the Bushmaster, which is quite, you know, it's a publicly known.
Yep,
we're doing that. They also said, well, we'll send over some of these cardboard aeroplanes with them. And we said, that's good. They'll get tested in the field and it's even better for us. And so we were happy to go along with that. And indeed, it's been quite a good testing ground for us, and we've been improving that product.
You must be doing something right, because if you've been supplying roughly 100 per month for 8 months, they wouldn't have kept buying them, Australia wouldn't have kept sending them, and our army buying them from you, I take it, they weren't successful.
Well, they are successful, and as I said, the Ukrainians, they do like them. The beauty of something like that, because it's really just a flying box, it actually allows the user to innovate, what we call innovate in the field. So basically, if you have something that, for instance, you can use them for simple radio repeaters where they just fly overhead.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a direct line of sight for your radios, you can't communicate over a hill or something like that. And these, you can fly these over the hill, between you and the hill, and you'll get radio communication because you've got a repeater on board. So there's a number of different uses for it.
Yeah.
And that just allows the person using it to innovate using this particular aircraft.
Yeah. George, it seems pretty extraordinary in that you obviously only, you and your team and your chief engineer only invented this autonomous cardboard drone, you know, what, last year or perhaps the year before, and got it to, a viable product last year. Who else in terms of perhaps countries might be using the Corvo drones?
Well, I can't confirm anything at the moment, but we have got, as a result of see, we've been doing this for a few months or nearly a year before we were able to announce
right.
it for obvious reasons. But we have got interest from a number of overseas countries at the moment. Obviously, our US is one of those, but there's a couple of other countries and regions that have shown interest.
Yeah, amazing. You have this relationship that you have with the Australian Defence, Australian Army, the Australian government. How did that come about, first of all?
Well, we've always been a defence-oriented business, even when we were purely contracting, consulting. We've been in business for just over 30 years. So you get to know your customers pretty well over that time. And we've got some, right now, our CEO is very well connected a girl called Amanda Holt. She's very well connected into defence. She sits on defence boards.
She's quite the impressive CEO, your Amanda Holt, or Mandy as you call her.
Mandy, she is indeed. She's a and in fact, she started with us as an engineering consultant, and she's grown from there.
Oh, really? That's great.
She's actually a remarkable woman.
Right. So she's got a lot of contacts there, and over the years, you have done what you've worked for the Army in terms of making their communications in the field very much next gen and also secure. You've also coordinated software development in their battlefield systems. I mean, you've done a lot of work for the armed forces.
We have indeed. If you go back over 20 or 30 years and you look at pretty well what they call major projects in defence, in some way or another, have been involved in pretty well, if not all of them, it'd be close to all of them.
Yeah, well, they are very big, complicated projects. I mean, protecting communications and making sure they're secure and, you know, battlefield systems integration, I imagine, are hugely complex systems.
They are indeed. They're becoming more and more, not so much more and more complex, but the capabilities you can build into them with miniaturization of the electronics and the very clever software, and now we're beginning to see AI applied to it. You can do it. They're very, very sophisticated.
Extraordinary. So are you using AI in your products?
It's just intelligence. To me, it's just intelligence. It's human intelligence integrated into a system.
Right.
And people call it artificial intelligence. Yes, it may be. But pretty well everything we design and build here in terms of products has some element of AI in it.
Yeah.
There's not much we don't do now that because they really have to not so much think for themselves, but do stuff autonomously without human intervention. So the human intelligence, or the intelligence that its builder has, needs to be built into the into the system. So
exactly. Yeah. And as well as the Australian Defence Force and federal government, you've helped some of their big departments with their systems integration too. Some of your partners are major tech firms, like well-known names like Atlassian and Microsoft. What do you do for those companies?
With both those companies, we are quite a significant Atlassian partner now, and essentially government and defence. And what makes us a bit different to your typical Atlassian partner is that we have we're all security cleared. Okay, so we have fairly what we'll call top level security clearance. So we can go into defence establishments and into their IT systems without them. We're a trusted supplier, if you know what I mean. So
without them what?
Without them worrying about it.
Right, so, I see. Yeah.
So they know we're a trusted supplier.
They know you
supplier.
And they trust you. Yeah.
And we're all security cleared to do that. So that's one thing that many of the other Atlassian and Microsoft partners cannot do, because they're just not cleared.
So what do you do for them? Something you can explain simply to a layperson like me?
Oh, well, you know, I'll give you an example. Atlassian out of the box is it can do stuff, but there's no workflows or business rules built into it.
Right.
So what we do for our customers there is we get it out of the box, install it, obviously, and then build their workflows and business rules into the system so that, you know, you start to get the full functionality of Atlassian as it was intended, because Atlassian's a productivity tool at the end of the day. But unless you build the customers or the users' workflows and processes and controls into that software, then it's pretty well, it's not going to maximise their productivity.
Right. George, go on.
No, that's all right.
I was going to say, you spent a number of years working in the Australian Air Force as a systems engineer, specialising in airborne electronic systems. So, in fact, back to the drone, it must be very much a love of yours. But why did you want to leave the Air Force and do your own thing? What made you want to start up your own business?
Look, I enlisted in the Air Force at 17.
So young.
Yes, very young. The Air Force, basically their superannuation system, as it was at the time, you could retire after 20 years and take a part of your salary as retirement income, a percentage of your salary. That wasn't the reason I left. It was mainly family reasons. You know, you have kids and you don't want to be moving around while they're going through secondary school that much. So we said, look, we've got to settle down. So by the time I'd, in fact, the Air Force was very good to me. I actually did my degree as a full-time student in the Air Force halfway through my career because I didn't have a tertiary degree up until then. So they paid my salary and all the costs of that, which was very, very good. And then by the time I finished that, my 20 years were nearly up. Essentially it was the family drivers that said, you know, it's time to get out. And I thought if I hang around too long, I wasn't 40 yet. So if I hang around too long, I'm then going to be, I find it difficult to find work outside of the Air Force.
So I decided to go then. Yeah. So you went in at 17, you left somewhere around 36, 37 years of age, which is very young. What do you think you learned in those two decades at the Air Force that you've taken with you when you started SciPac and that stays with you today, perhaps even?
Well, if you've got a couple of hours, I can show you
about it. Give us the short version.
Look, there's a few essential things. One of them, and a really important thing that I learned, certainly as an engineer in the Air Force, is that the civilian version of it, the customer is always right. We had young pilots and airmen flying off, putting their lives in danger, and we the engineers stay home and either fix, modify, or prepare the aircraft for them. And my view was, if those guys are going out there and at that aluminium tube, and putting their lives in danger, then it is indeed my responsibility to make sure they have a successful mission and they get home safely. So that's one thing I learned, and we still have, it's certainly one of the key cornerstones of what we believe in SciPac or in our business. So I learned that. The other thing, oddly enough, I was in charge of a team of engineers, although I had some rank, I wasn't one who wanted to pull rank to get something done or convince someone that they should be doing something. And I was driving home from work one day, and there was basically a blizzard and pouring rain and hail. And I turned to look out my car window, and there's a hockey team practicing. And then I realised two of my engineers were there practicing in that field hockey team. And I thought, what the devil would convince someone to go out in that weather for no good reason? And I realised then, it hit me, it's team. You do it for the team. You don't want to let your team down. You want the team to succeed. And from then on, I said, everything in my world, in my work life, and beyond, has been about team. if it's not good for the team, it's not good for anybody. You got to keep showing up because the team needs you. You know, so that's another thing I learned, mainly because I thought I don't know whether because you've got rank here on your shoulder, that entitles you to tell someone that they should go out and get shot. You know,
yeah.
Well,
that's what happens in the army and in the armed forces. Well,
that's why the way they operate. But I had a slightly different view.
Yeah.
I thought, why would someone want to do that? And I think, to me, it was about team. It's about your mates and your team.
Yeah. George, tell us about the beginning of your business journey then. How did you come up with the idea that I'm going to do consulting at first, which I guess was a natural step, having come out still as a young man from the Air Force? But how did you develop this very sophisticated integrated systems, producing very highly sophisticated technical products?
When I got out of the Air Force, I did work for a year or so on a very complex project. It's called the Jindalee Over the Horizon.
Ah, yes, I was going to ask you about that, the JAWN project. Just briefly remind my listeners what that is. This is the Over the Horizon radar.
Yes, and that project was probably the last major full-on development project that Defence has done in Australia. There's others, but this was one of the last. Anyway, it's a very sophisticated system. It actually uses, it's in the what we call the high frequency band of frequencies, you might recall when we were using shortwave radios, you could actually, or even AM radios, not so much now, but AM radios, you could actually pick up Port Moresby that night.
Yeah.
So that particular range of frequencies bounces off the ionosphere, and that means it's got incredible range, and that's what JAWN is, just high frequency. It works in that band, so it's actually about the signals that it receives back as a radar being bounced off the ionosphere.
Right. So you got a lot of expertise as well as experience working on that.
I was on that project as a systems engineer and a bit of project management and systems engineering and what they call configuration management. But not long after I started working on that project, I loved it as an engineer. It was a great job, but I was actually working for Telecom or Telstra, as it's known now, and I wasn't a big fan of, I won't go into it, but I just felt like I was working in the public service rather than as an individual on a project. So anyway, I decided to start my own business, and it dawned on me, if you're going to start your own business, it's a bit like, being an artist. You say, well, I'm an artist. Why would I go into a business that's not to do with art? So I figured I might as well go into a business that I'm good at, and that was systems engineering and project management. So SIPAC, if it is a word, is a concatenation of systems, projects and quality.
Right, and systems, project and quality.
Exactly. So that prompted me to start as a consultant because I didn't have any financial backing. In fact,
I was going to say, where did the funds come from to even start a business?
Out of my back pocket.
So credit card got maxed out, or did you borrow from the bank?
The credit card got a fair pounding. But the beauty of consulting is it's what we call time and material. So you do get paid on a regular basis, effectively.
Mm.
And so I was able to. I did. It was not capital intensive, if you know what I mean.
At the beginning,
At the beginning. So by starting that way, it meant I could get started and as an individual, independent contractor.
Yeah, and get your foot in the door of the industry and your name known.
Exactly.
But how did you then scale up and how did you grow it and expand the business?
That's interesting. I started, actually the first project, a couple of projects I got were actually in China, and it was working for a company called Olex Cables, which manufactured, amongst other types of cables, fiber optical communications cable. And they were part of the Pacific Dunlop group at the time, and they were doing projects in China, basically communications-based projects in China. And I said, oh, I haven't been to China, but I'll give it a go. And so anyway, we got to the stage of those projects where it came to test the systems, and the customer said, oh, we don't have anybody who knows how to do that. I said, just hang on a minute, let me make a couple of phone calls. So I rang a couple of friend mates and said, would you like to work a few months' work testing these systems? And
what, get up here to China ASAP?
So they said, yeah, why not? So you built a team around me of other consultants and contractors, and we did that. And from there, yeah, you like to say the rest is history, but it never is linear. Business is up and down.
Yeah. How much of a struggle do you reckon those early years were? And then when you actually started to sort of really introduce products?
Now, the early years, they were a struggle. Of course, you don't notice how much of a struggle it is because you're so busy. You're so busy trying to do what you do, get cash in the door, et cetera. And you've got to realize that you're not only doing the work, I've actually at night I'm doing the invoicing and, collecting the money as
exactly.
well.
Exactly.
And then my wife, Anna, we had five kids at the time. And so it wasn't easy for her either. So she was incredible. She did a lot of the bookkeeping work and get the household going. While I was
amazing duo, it sounds like.
We are. And she's an incredible project manager herself, in terms of what she does and what she's been able to do.
Yeah. George, was it always a grand vision for you, what you were going to do at SciPac, or was it, I'll just try this, I'll do a bit of consulting, I'll just see where it goes?
No, look, I'd have to say right from the start, I did see, my ambition was to build a sustainable business and basically build it to where we are an Australian home. What I said earlier, prime systems integrator, and a prime systems integrator is someone in the ilk of British Airways, BAE, those sort of people. Now, we may never be that large, but we're on that journey now. But that we've always had that ambition. You might remember a company called Tenix, which is then sold to BAE, but that was an Australian owned. Prime systems integrator, and I've always said to our people, we want to be the next 10X, which is Australian owned but multinational systems integrator in complex.
And you're on the pathway to that.
Well, we are. As I said, it's never linear. I like to think we take two steps forward and one, maybe one backwards, not the other way around. But it's never linear. Just when you think you're getting somewhere, something happens and you've got to rethink it. But I'm a firm believer in setting your goals in concrete and your plans in sand. So if something happens, then you can go to plan B, plan C if you need to.
That sounds like a great place to take a break. I've still got a lot of things I want to ask you, George Vecino.
Sure.
Will you stay around and join me for part two of this chat?
I'd absolutely love to. Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed Build It, They'll Come. Let me know via Twitter and LinkedIn. Better still, let your family, friends, and colleagues know by sharing it around your networks.
And I'd love you to give it a star rating on Apple Podcasts to make it easier for others to find us. Be sure to subscribe, as there are plenty of upcoming episodes you don't want to miss, with more amazing innovators and entrepreneurs on how they turn their light bulb idea into an empire.